Hey everybody, welcome back to my channel. Thanks so much for tuning in. My name is Dana Trupiana and I cover infamous gangsters every week in a true crime-like format. My show, Mob Times, comes out every Tuesday, so make sure to tune in on Tuesday to take a look at any new episodes that I may have coming out. Or you could just turn on notifications for my channel and you'll be alerted whenever a new video is posted from my channel. Okay, so we're about to get started on part 3 of Angelo Leonardo. And honestly, this series is going really amazingly. I'm in talks with the Cleveland family about going there this month, and I'm hoping to get some interviews and materials for the last episode that I'm doing of the series. On top of that, I have people that I can reach out to if I have any questions that I don't know the answer to. I have access to information that isn't available online anywhere, so I may be putting out some things that have never been heard before. And I just love that whole thing. I love being in communication with the family. I love everything about knowing the entire situation. I would really like feedback from you guys as well. Are you enjoying the Angelo Leonardo series now that we're on part 3? Are you guys excited for this episode and super excited for 2 or 3 more about Angelo? Or are you kind of like over it and ready for me to move on to another gangster? I'm definitely finishing this series up, so I hate to tell you this, but no matter what your answers are, there's gonna be 2 or 3 more episodes about Angelo. But it's a good question for me to ask just because I want to feel out how people feel about me doing part 1, 2, 3, whatever, for future gangsters. So please weigh in. Please let me know. I'm super interested. So just a quick update. I am, in fact, still sick. I'm pretty convinced that I'm gonna be sick for the rest of my life. So I'm sorry if, once again, I sound like I'm holding my nose because I have absolutely zero airflow going through my nose. So I sound like an idiot yet again. I'm truly sorry. I'm serious. Like, I know I always sound like an idiot and I apologize. And I don't know if it's ever gonna get any better. Also, if you hear snoring, my dog is sleeping on the bed. I'll put a little picture of him right here and you can see what he looks like, but I can't really do anything about the fact that he's snoring, so I'm sorry. Okay, so I'm gonna try to get through a huge chunk of information in this week's episode because for some reason, I don't know why, but I feel like I haven't gotten through any actual information on Angelo in these 2 episodes. So let's go ahead and forge forward, shall we? Week, I left you guys off with a cliffhanger and told you that you would have to come to this episode to see what Angelo talks about in his testimony. And we're going to talk about that now. During his testimony, Angelo explains that in the late 1940s, he was invited into a room at the Statler Hotel. And this isn't just any room. He walks into the room and who's sitting in there? He sees the acting boss, John Scalish, who, remember, is Angelo's brother-in-law. He sees the underboss of the family, Tony Milano, his godfather's brother, and 2 other high-ranking capos of the family, John DeMarco, who is his cousin, and Frank Brancato, which I don't know if there's any actual familial relation with Brancato. So this isn't something that most guys can say, because most of the time when something like this is going on, a high stress situation like you being made, the high ranking members that are in the room aren't literally your family. They're just like your mafia family. But Angelo has his actual family there for him. And that makes him very lucky because this is a very high stress situation. And that has to be comforting to a certain level. They ask if he knows what he's doing here. And of course he knows. But he says no, because you're supposed to act like you have no idea why you're here. This is a complete surprise coming out of nowhere. I have absolutely no clue what I could possibly be doing here right now. It's a really big deal, and the higher-ups that are there, they're really excited to provide a really cool experience for the new guy that they have spent such a long time mentoring and bringing up through the ranks, teaching them the ways of the mafia, so they're all really excited, and he doesn't want to spoil that. It would be like super lame if he turns around and he's like, yeah, I know why I'm here. I'm being made. Like, if he did do that, they may just turn around and, like, pull a piece out and pretend that they're gonna whack you if you do that. Like, oh no, you're not here to be made. You're here to be killed, you know? Like, and he would deserve it if they did that because it's just, that would ruin the fun. So, he says no. Thank God. He says no. So this little ritual is one where Angelo Leonardo is being made into La Cosa Nostra. Everything is read off for him. The rules and regulations of mob life, what's expected of him, what he's expected to stay away from, everything that is expected of him is read off in this room right here and now. They go through the whole thing. You're not allowed to mess around with drugs or narcotics, as they call them. No running a brothel or having any prostitutes work for you in any way. And hands off the wives of your fellow wise guys. Which is necessary to say because I feel like there's a lot of infighting over that kind of stuff. So they feel like it's necessary to get it off the jump, like, hey, do not go near the wife of your fellow maid guy because you'll die for it. Because let's be real, this is a gang of guys, and guys suck. I know most of the people listening right now are guys, okay? I look at my statistics, I know who likes my videos. But let's be real here, guys, you're all dogs, okay? I love you to death, but you're all dogs. They keep going, and they tell him that if he has anything shady, any criminal enterprises, they have to run it by the boss and get the green light, and then they have to kick a percentage upstairs, and everybody gets a piece. This is like mob orientation 101. P.S. I do have to interject here and say that I think that it's absolutely wild that on initiation into the mafia, you're told that you can't have anything to do with prostitution, especially considering that the founder of the mafia, Lucky Luciano, was sentenced to 30 to 50 years in prison for, what was it again? Oh yeah, compulsory prostitution. That means that not only did he have prostitutes, but he forced women to be prostitutes. But there's no way that he actually did that, right? That's just the feds making shit up to, I don't know, keep a mobster down. Go check out the Luciano episode if you're interested in that story, but I don't know. A lot of people say that they don't believe that he did that. But it really doesn't even matter. I just think it's interesting that out of all the rules that you could be given on initiation, the fact that you can't have prostitutes is at the very top. But hey, maybe it's at the very top because it took out Luciano, who was the founder of the mafia, and they knew how bad you could get screwed for it, so I don't know. So then comes the million-dollar question. Does he want to jump into this crazy world? Now, at this point, you could still technically bail out. But let's be real, who is going to? In order to get made, you have to put years of work in. And Angelo sure was not going to be the first to say no. Once he's officially given them a yes and confirmed that he's in it for the long haul, they take the sheet off the table that's sitting in front of him. And on the table is a dagger and a gun. He describes how they hand him a card with a saint on it. And they light the card on fire and they place it in your hands. And you have to kind of like toss it back and forth in each hand to avoid burning your hand. And you have to keep tossing it until it turns to ashes. Then, just to amp things up, they prick your finger with a dagger. They draw some blood. And that's it. You are now officially a member of this thing of ours. Now, back in the day, you had to whack somebody and stand tall under police scrutiny in order to even be considered to be given your button, which is just a different way to say become a maid guy. Nowadays, you don't necessarily have to take a life, but you do have to prove that you're a stand-up kind of guy. But then now really doesn't matter If the call comes to pop somebody, you better be ready to pop somebody. It's explained on multiple occasions by a whole bunch of different dudes that if you're given the order to whack someone and you refuse, you end up being the one to get whacked. For instance, I just talked about this last week when I talked about Joseph Lombardo. He sat in the dentist chair as he was having his teeth worked on by the brother of two men that he helped kill. And he tells this dude that if he didn't kill his brothers, the family would have killed his brothers and then killed him and buried him in the same hole. Point being, this is a common sentiment across the board, so even though I don't really trust every word that Angelo said during his testimony, this is one thing that is definitely true. Now, remember, back in 1927, Angelo worked with his cousin, Dominic Sospirato, to take out Salvatore Todaro in a revenge murder plot to avenge his father, Big Joe Leonardo. Well, in the 1930s, Angelo and his cousin, John DeMarco, had yet another bone to pick. Dr. Joseph Romano is a literal doctor, a surgeon, and is also the former boss of the Cleveland Mafia family. Big Ange felt that Dr. Romano had a hand in Big Joe's murder. And they also suspected that Dr. Romano had offed their cousin during a surgery. This was one of the most difficult pieces of information to find because I could not, no matter how long I searched, I could not for the life of me figure out who Big Ange thought that Dr. Romano killed in surgery. Well, I found it because I am amazing. Big Ange thought that Romano killed Dominic DeMarco, Big Ange's cousin, and the man who was leading the Licatese faction at the time. We talked about DeMarco a little earlier when we talked about where Big Ange went to stay after he killed Black Sam Todaro. Big Ange, as well as DeMarco's brother, John DeMarco, was convinced that Dr. Romano botched the surgery completely on purpose. Domenico DeMarco was killed on November 23rd, 1935, during a surgery that he was having in Cleveland. He was only 29 years old when he died, so it's kind of easy to understand why people would be suspicious of that. 29-year-old men don't typically die during surgery, and it's not like this doctor is just a straight-shooting guy. It makes sense. He's not completely wild for believing that. Also, another thing that doesn't really get talked about a lot, like I've never seen it anywhere but one source, is that our good old Dr. Romano was a rat. Romano stood trial and testified against Big Ange about the murder of Sam Todaro. Now, obviously, Romano becomes next on their hit list. And now the new cousin pair, because remember, Dominic Sospirato was the first cousin pair. Now we got John DeMarco, this is the new cousin pair. Together, they worked together to take Dr. Romano out. But there's an issue. Angelo was not part of La Cosa Nostra at the time, but John DeMarco was. I don't know if you've heard the rules or anything lately, but it is definitely not okay to just go around killing bosses of the families. While Angelo wasn't punished because he wasn't officially a member of La Cosa Nostra at the time, a hit was put on John DeMarco's head. The shady thing here is that Angelo swore until the day he died that he talked to Frank Milano about killing Dr. Romano before he did it. Angelo says that he went to Milano, got the approval for the assassination, and then he carried out the hit. He says that Milano turned around and played dumb afterwards, saying that he never gave authorization for the hit, but he definitely got it. I'm willing to bet that put a nice little wedge in the friendship because Angelo or his cousin easily could have gotten killed over this little mix-up. So whether or not permission was given, I'm willing to bet either permission was given and Milano didn't get the permission that he was supposed to get, so he turned around and said, nope, I never gave it, or there was a miscommunication. Angelo went to Milano, talked to him, thought he got the okay, and in Milano's eyes, he didn't give the okay, but Angelo perceived it as the okay. I don't know, one of those two. I'm willing to bet that Angelo didn't just make up that he gave the okay. But at the end of the day, either way, these guys are not going to feel great about each other after this little mix-up. Like, this is a very dangerous game these guys are playing. There was a whole commission hearing on it in Miami. And according to Leonardo, he didn't even know it was a commission meeting until after it happened, when Al Polizzi came out. Al Polizzi, the acting boss of the Cleveland family, was there to argue on behalf of DeMarco. And he must have done a good job of it, because his life was spared. DeMarco was not killed. As much as Leonardo says that he was spared because he wasn't a member of La Cosa Nostra yet, blah, blah, blah. Listen, guys, have you guys ever heard the story about the guy that hit and killed John Gotti's kid on the dirt bike? I promise you that no matter how hard you look, you will not find that man today. The fact that Leonardo is not a member of La Cosa Nostra, especially since he knows the rules very well, he grew up with Big Joe as his father, this boy definitely had a hit out on his head as well. It doesn't matter that he wasn't a member of La Cosa Nostra. He would have died just as easily, if not more easily, than John DeMarco. I don't know why they even bothered to waste their breath saying, like, well, he wasn't a member of La... No, you die faster for that. At least they'd be a little more hesitant to put a hit out on a made guy. On a guy that doesn't have as many years put into this thing as a made guy does, I feel like they'd kill him way faster. But the argument was, hey, he wasn't a member of La Cosa Nostra yet. He didn't know the rules. He didn't know that he wasn't supposed to kill him and blah, 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 blah. I don't know. That's the reason that the conversation came up that he wasn't a made guy yet. But still, it just seems like he would be killed faster than DeMarco. And Angelo kind of put it out there like, well, I wasn't in La Cosa Nostra yet, so I was spared. No, bullshit. You had a hit out on you too. They just spared your feelings and hid that from you. Okay, so now let's fast forward. Ange is a main guy, which is really cool. It's something that he wanted his entire life. His dad being Big Joe, the entire family wrapped up in the mafia. I can only imagine that Angelo getting his button is something that he literally dreamed of from the day he knew what the word family meant. So what does a day in the life look like? Angelo had a crew that he ran out of the Frolics Club, which is considered a girly joint, aka a strip club, on Vincent Avenue in downtown Cleveland. Big Ange is by far one of the most well-respected mafiosi to ever exist. I'm talking anywhere. New York, Chicago, California, anywhere. This boy had respect from every single person. Especially right now, Angelo was fresh out of jail for killing Todaro. The Pirellos had just been taken out on behalf of Angelo's family. The hero worship from everybody around him for this boy is real. There's money coming out of the wazoo. Not only does he have his illegal rackets going on, but he also has legit businesses going on as well. Angelo owned restaurants, bars, nightclubs, all kinds of entertainment joints. They have schemes going left and right that are making money for them. And one of the big things that are making money for them is the unions. They controlled all kinds of unions. Garbage unions, construction unions. The Cleveland family even controlled the bartenders union. Hotel service workers unions. Restaurant employees unions. They've got racetracks. They've got skin in all of the games. They're in vending machines and the unions that control them. In fact, the president of the Vending Machine Service Employees Union, Local 410, his name is John Nardi, just so happens to be a main guy and a member of the Cleveland Mafia family. Everybody is family. Everyone in Cleveland is related to each other in one way or another, and they plant people that are related to them in high positions in the unions all over the city. Something that I don't really see people talking about a lot that I would be super interested to see in person is that during Prohibition, the Cleveland Mafia used a system of underground tunnels so that they could transport illegally produced alcohol from one place to another without getting caught by the cops or anything like that. After Prohibition was overturned, you can't tell me that there was absolutely no use for an entire system of underground tunnels throughout an entire city. Like, I know New York has something similar. They even had, like, dumbwaiters that would transport illegal alcohol from one part of the building to the other to avoid Prohibition agents finding the alcohol. But as far as I could tell, they didn't have a whole-ass system of tunnels set up. Actually, interestingly enough, there was just some drama in New York City over a secret tunnel that was found under a synagogue in New York City, and a fight broke out down there. It wasn't an elaborate system of tunnels like Cleveland or anything, but from what I could tell, it was just like a room that had been dug out under the building. But that makes me super uncomfortable about the fact that standing in that building was probably so much more dangerous than standing in the building next to it, because the ground underneath it had to have been compromised. And like, literally, okay, one of my worst fears is to be in a situation like that, like a collapsed building, fire in a building, whatever. I grew up smack dab in the 9/11 generation, so that's some of my worst fears come to life. As a professional who has always worked in New York City, I feel pretty justified when I say that whoever did this is a goddamn idiot, should go to jail. Even though it's like a tiny little room, it still petrifies me that you could be standing in that building and have no idea that there's an entire room dug out below it that's compromising the integrity of the entire building you're standing in. Either way, I still want to know what the hell those tunnels under Cleveland are doing now. Like, I know that they exist, they're open to the public and everything, but you can't tell me the mafia doesn't have something going on with those tunnels still. No way. They've definitely still got to be doing shit down there. Like, maybe they have, like, illegal poker games going on down there. Maybe they're running drugs down there. I don't know. They had to have figured out some cool way to utilize them. Angelo definitely knew about these tunnels, too. His dad practically built the Cleveland Mafia. So, holy shit, I just looked it up, and you can literally buy tickets and go walk through these tunnels. They have, like, tunnel tours in Cleveland. That is freaking epic. So, now that I'm looking into it, these tunnels were originally built for travel during the Civil War. Honestly, you'd probably never in a million, billion, trillion years catch me down there, but it seems like something cool for other people to check out who don't have a crippling fear of being trapped in a collapsed structure. But yeah, if you're ever in Cleveland, go check that out. That seems really cool. So it seems like there's different parts of these tunnels. And one specific part of these tunnels open up for a very short period of time nowadays for the public to see. These tunnels open up for only 2 days a year in April. Last year, it was April 29th and 30th. There's other parts of the tunnels that are open year-round, but I guess there's specific parts that aren't open year-round. The tunnels are built in concentric circles, and they run below the public square. There's a whole other set of tunnels that used to be used as an underground transportation system, and they stopped operating in 1954. Something that's really cool about that is you can even go down there and you can see an abandoned train car that still sits down there. It seems like it would be a cool little, like, fun day to go check it out. But yeah, that has nothing to do with the story, but I just got interested because it's like, you always hear, like, these myths about underground tunnels that were built and blah, 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 but, like, Cleveland really has them. So let's get back to the mafia. Now, during this time, Al Polizzi, the leader of the Cleveland Mafia, got the Cleveland Mafia back under control. Things had been so hot, and there had been so many bodies dropping all over the place, and Polizzi was not about that life. He far preferred to, like, pay people off over killing and threatening them. He did not want to be raining violence down on the city of Cleveland. He had companies all over the place doing both legal and illegal business. A lot of the legal companies that he had were the legal side of doing the illegal activities that he had. And the legal companies that he had would launder the money for the illegal companies. And obviously that's so that he wouldn't catch a tax evasion charge, because that is a very scary charge. We do not want to go there. So, like, yeah, he had illegal gambling operations, but he also owned casinos that had restaurants, catering, and legal luxury gambling, and all of those places were legit. They had licenses, they paid their taxes, they did everything right, other than the money laundering thing. Yeah, he was a bootlegger, and even after Prohibition, he sold illegal alcohol. But he also had companies that made the legal components of alcohol, dehydrated molasses. He had distilleries, brewing companies, all of that, and that was all legal. He had the licenses, he followed the laws, and they would just launder the money for the illegal alcohol sales. Seems like a freaking brilliant setup, honestly. And what Italian mafia member would be worth his salt without a company that made and sold olive oil, pasta, and tomato paste? Not Polizzi. He owned Tornello Importing Co. with Frank Milano, and when Milano hightailed it out of America, Polizzi had that company on his own. But I'm sure that the profits were going to Milano in Mexico. Like, realistically speaking, there's no way Milano wasn't still benefiting from that. And honestly, I kind of think that Polizzi may have been just kind of a frontman for Milano. When he was boss, he became boss after Milano left for Mexico. It's very possible that he was just the acting boss and Milano was the actual boss and he was leading shit from Mexico. He couldn't be the street boss because he couldn't be there every day, but the way that a boss would run shit from jail, Milano probably ran shit from Mexico. Polizzi, like Milano, had a seat on the commission and he became besties with Frank Costello, Joe Adonis, Lucky Luciano, and Joe Perfacci. His partnership with the Jewish Boys helped a lot with his power within the National Crime Syndicate, since Mo Dalitz was a ranking member there. And mafia historians say that the syndicate actually told Polizzi that Dalitz was the real authority in Cleveland. While Angelo Linardo may have had bad blood with Milano over the little scuffle where Angelo claims he got permission to kill Dr. Romano and Milano swears that he never gave it, Polizzi was the one that defended Angelo and made sure that he and his cousin, John DeMarco, weren't killed. Leonardo and Polizzi were really close. They had a really good relationship. Now, let's talk about the 50s. The commission put a freeze on making new members. Why? Because some families, especially in New York, were letting in people that didn't exactly fit the mafia mold. Rumor has it that some big shots even coughed up 50 grand to score a spot in La Cosa Nostra. Well, who do we know that could have charged $50,000 for spots in La Cosa Nostra? Oh yeah, it was Albert Anastasia. Remember, he was selling buttons for $50,000, and when he got caught, he totally put the blame on his underboss, Frank Scalise, who ended up getting whacked for it. On top of that, his brother ended up having to be killed because he could just not get over his brother being killed unfairly. What a crybaby. Now we're getting into the era of John Skalish, the boss who ran the show from around 1949 until his passing in 1976. He was given the position of boss of the family in 1945 after Al Polizzi retired as boss of the family. Polizzi did a 2-year stint in federal after selling liquor illegally, and when he got out of jail, he decided, like, this is not the life for him. He doesn't want this anymore. He is done. He retired to Coral Gables, Florida. He continued doing business with the Cleveland Syndicate and the Cleveland Mafia alike, but he just didn't want that title of boss of the family anymore. Scalish took on the role of boss of the family with Polizzi's blessing, and a whole new era began for the Mayfield Road Mafia. Now, in 1949, the Cleveland crew had around 50 to 60 members, and Scalish was just fine with that. Scalish was not in the mood to be adding new faces into the family. He decided, no new blood for us. So, as a consequence of that, as time went on, the Cleveland family's strength started to dwindle. Members would age, they would die, and no new faces were being made, and things started to get pretty quiet. Scalish stuck around until he died in 1976, but one of the main reasons for the slump that the Cleveland family saw was their aversion to bring on any new blood. Polizzi before him, Scalish after, they just did not want to extend the family tree at all whatsoever. They wanted no new made men. The Cleveland guys had an issue with making men before the official freeze was put in place from New York in 1957. And that would completely bar any new members from getting their button all the way up to 1976, when they would slowly start making new members. And at that point, people started to be able to be made, but it was a very, very slow process. In 1976, the commission authorized each of the five families to make 10 new members. They said that they were giving each of the five families 10 new members, but there isn't any word about the outliers like Cleveland or Chicago. But given the attitude from Cleveland in the past, I don't think that they were exactly itching to make new guys anyway. Even in 1976, after the books had been closed officially for 19 years, Gambino still fought hard against opening the books back up. They really only got opened up again because Carmine Galante was such a loud and obnoxious guy. But that's a story for the Galante video. I did that. Go check out that video if you're interested in. But Galante was very loud, obnoxious, boisterous, and he wanted to make a lot of new guys. And he fought Gambino hard. Also, it didn't hurt that Carlo Gambino died in October of 1976. And a lot of the time leading up to 76, a lot of the bosses would tell the new guys, like, hey, just wait it out. Gambino's gonna die, and when Gambino dies, we'll be able to make new members. Gambino was the biggest roadblock in making new guys. He wanted no part of new made members. Right around the time that the books were opened up again, one of the guys that were proposed for membership was Donnie Brasco. Brasco, or Joseph Pistone, was an undercover agent who infiltrated the Bonanno family from 1976 to 1981. So he was slipped into the position right around the time that the books just opened up again, around the time that Gambino died. And that shit irritates my very soul. I hate Donnie Brasco. I hate Joseph Pistone. Even though I'm fully convinced that he tried to leave the FBI and go into the mafia, I still hate him. But the fact that he really did want to leave the FBI and go into the mafia, I feel like that tells you something about which of the two is the better organization.
My history, I went to college. I went to Ohio State University. So I have had no interaction with organized crime in my life.
Okay.
To say that I had an uncle of mine was a very successful bookie. And I've had a couple other relatives that are successful bookies. But my family is from Naples on my father's side and Rome on my mother's side. And have not been in the mafia, in organized crime, as far as I know. And myself...
No charges have been pressed.
I mean, of course I know people, and I have met people that are alleged organized crime people, but what I've seen most of my life, the people that I read about, and the ones that I know are gentlemen. And the children of all these people that I read about are all good kids. Most of them are very educated. Most of them are very successful. And most of these people have lived to a ripe old age and died naturally. I mean...
So they weren't murdered, is what you're saying?
No.
Okay. So this restaurant, just for a little bit of background, this restaurant is on Mayfield Road, which if you watch my Big Joe Leonardo episode, the name of his little crime group was the Mayfield Road Mob. And I was talking to you a little bit earlier about Big Joe's involvement in the Mayfield Road Mafia. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Well, when you say Mayfield Road Mafia, it's really the Mayfield Road Mob.
Okay.
And if you watch the movie The Godfather,
okay,
there is a direct reference to the Mayfield Road guys.
Okay.
That's the reference in the movie The Godfather.
Okay.
Okay, so it was the five families in New York. the Mayfield Road Mob in Cleveland. In Detroit, it was the Purple Gang. And in Chicago, it was Al Capone. Okay, that is kind of what I would call mob history, lining those states right along the Great Lakes. That's the way I would take the whole bootlegging and the whole businesses that occurred in that order. And to my knowledge, and from what I've ever read, I did not know Mr. Leonardo was associated with the Maple Road mob guys. Those were three or four Jewish gentlemen and three or four Italian gentlemen. And the same four Jewish guys were known as the Cleveland Four. And I recently read this by kind of a weird coincidence. I had a couple guys in my restaurant from Newport, Kentucky, which you can check my history on this, is reputedly number one, the first original Sin City in the United States.
So it was kind of similar to Las Vegas, or it was Las Vegas Las Vegas was Las Vegas?
Yes, it was. Okay. I mean, before Vegas really flew the way it did. But, of course, everything was illegal in Newport. Okay. It was the way everything was run. And the four gentlemen, Mo Dalitz, Kleinman, and there was a guy named Turner, I believe, four guys. They basically were considered the Cleveland Four.
Okay.
And they were part of the Mayfield Road Mob.
Okay.
And to my knowledge, Mr. Leonardo was not involved with them. And to my knowledge, these guys were associated with Meyer Lansky and the guys from New York.
Okay.
These were four very sharp gentlemen. And they operated, I'd say, I can't remember exactly, 15 to 20 years in Newport. And Newport was considered Sin City, USA. And I know people from Cleveland and people from Detroit, and they all kind of entered that city and enjoyed the gambling and all the other activities that occurred in that city. And I read a really good article last week, mainly because these gentlemen were in my restaurant, and they told me, we're from Newport. We are from the original Sin City, U.S. And that's the first time I ever heard of Newport, let alone the first time I heard that story. In the mid-60s, these guys all left this city because they changed the government, and they were forced out. And then all these Cleveland guys then skedaddled to Las Vegas. And that's when Las Vegas... That's the beginning.
So you're saying that so I actually did a video for my listeners. I did a video on Virginia Woolf, and she was the girl behind Bugsy Siegel, and Bugsy Siegel is the person that kind of created Las Vegas. So you're saying that the Cleveland Mafia was a little bit involved in the making of Las Vegas?
I think they were a big part of it.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me a little bit about that. What kind of history do you know about that?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, my grandfather used to go to Las Vegas often. And I know he went to the Stardust. And I know he went to the Tropicana. And, you know, and because when I was a kid, I was very little, I saw all the ashtrays and stirrers and hotel paraphernalia that he would bring back. And he would give some stuff to me as a kid. And I didn't know anything about it. My grandfather and his friends, they drank wine, homemade wine. They sang, and they booked bets, okay? And they were a great group of guys. I've never saw anyone that loved their families more, that took care of their families better, and loved life more than my grandfather and his friends. And my grandfather's friends were Italian, Irish, and Jewish. And they all loved each other to the same level. And it's funny because I know my grandfather's friends' children and grandchildren. And I still, they come in my restaurant and we reminisce about our grandparents and their parents. But, you know, when you're growing up around that, you really don't think of it as anything wrong because it's gambling. And I know gambling was illegal and is illegal, but it was so prevalent around Italian Americans and Italian American communities throughout this whole state, Youngstown and Niles and all them great little cities with great Italian American families all around there. And then we're talking about Newport and Covington, Kentucky, and Wheeling, West Virginia. All that fun ran rampant over there, and those people, nobody got bothered, really. I mean, I don't know the whole story, but it was. I never thought about it as crime when I was a kid, and I didn't think because I knew guys were booking bets in my family that it was a crime. I thought it was a little business, you know. That's the way I looked.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's the way I looked at it.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's very rare that any adult would explain the mafia and crime to a kid. So that's usually the story. It's like, I didn't know until I was older that there's crime going on around me.
Well, you know, I mean, when I was 12 or 13, I started asking my mother and father about what the mafia was. Because people in school would talk about it, and I was inquisitive. And then, of course, we start reading about Al Capone and different gangsters. I mean, it was, a lot of us had an affinity towards all that, and especially, I mean, Al Capone was a famous or infamous gangster, depending on what side of the fence you were looking at him. An interesting man. Unbelievably successful man at what he did. But that whole bootlegging thing, like I said, it occurred from New York, to Erie, PA, to Cleveland, Ohio, all along the Great Lakes, Detroit, because of the Canadian connections, and of course Chicago. I mean, and that's why all that business thrived, and that was what it was all about, you know.
Now, quick, I know the first question that everybody's going to ask. Any relation to Quentin Tarantino?
Well, if I was related to Quentin, and if he ever sees me, I hope he puts me in one of his movies because I'm working too damn hard in the restaurant business.
So not as far as you know.
I do not know. My family is from Benevento, Italy. And if his family is from Benevento, we're related.
So tell me a little bit about your involvement with, I mean, I know that you're not involved in organized crime, but so, first of all, have you ever seen The Sopranos?
I have.
So you know how Anthony's like best friend is the restaurant owner?
Yeah.
And he's like very involved. He's not in the mafia, but he's very involved.
Yeah.
Is there any, in your experience, is there any legitimacy to that?
I believe that as far as now in Cleveland, we don't have organized crime in Cleveland right now.
None.
Cleveland's a pretty clean city right
now.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I would say that. So it's not like I haven't met people earlier in my life. I have, but we don't have that right now in Cleveland. And I would guess the closest thing I have to a godfather coming in my restaurant is Mike Fratello, the basketball coach from New Jersey, who's not a crime czar.
He's not.
He's not
a crime czar.
No, he's a basketball czar.
Oh,
he's the czar of basketball.
Not involved in crime whatsoever.
No, and Mike...
Not involved in crime
Mike
whatsoever.
Mike has treated me like a little brother. So I have been very lucky by a lot of Italian Americans in this city, in Cleveland, showing kindness and helping me in my business. So I have been treated very well. But all the people that treat me well are upstanding, tax-paying citizens. And, I mean, those days are kind of over in Cleveland right now, you know? I mean, it's a different kind of city.
So I know me and you were speaking earlier, and we were talking about Sammy the Bull, how he had reached out to you a while back. Tell me a little bit about that.
He didn't reach out to me. Somebody that represented him, and I don't know how far they were from representing him, they called me. They wanted to do a luncheon here,
okay.
And I'm not open for lunch. If I was open for lunch and they came in, I would have accommodated them. But I didn't want to do a private lunch for a guy that I just heard some things about and didn't really know about. And this is about 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago.
And, so before his podcast blew up and he became famous for that, he was still just famous for being a snitch.
Right. Well, and again, I don't know what he did. And as I have listened to his podcast and I have seen what he supposedly snitched on and, you know, and who started what and when they started it and who did what first, I have no idea. And anybody that picks sides when they have no idea what really is going on, listening to sound devices planted by the FBI or whoever, I don't know who to trust.
Yeah.
So I don't know who is right and who is wrong. And I do know I got that call and I wasn't open for lunch. And I wasn't going to open for lunch for 6 or 8 people. And, you know, the other thing is, when you do anything as an Italian-American, and when you do anything with anybody, and this is kind of a sad thing to say, but people still have all kinds of notions, and people always try to put 2 and 2 together. When I was young, I would go on a date and a girl would ask me if I was in the mafia, or a girl would, and you know, I'd laugh. I mean, I was a student at Ohio State. And, I mean, I wasn't doing it. I was landscaping. I had a really big tan from being outside and digging ditches all day long. And, you know, you laugh. And then when I was in Columbus, Ohio, and I would date somebody there, they would ask me if I ever killed anybody. You know, I mean, did you ever kill anybody?
That's the question that comes to their mind.
Well, but yeah. I mean, and you know, and you really start laughing, and you're like, first of all, you start laughing, and then you say, if I did kill somebody, I'm going to
tell you.
and then why would you ask that? You know, and these people would actually be kind of like excited about the answer. And I would shake my head. But that's, you know, it's just about stereotypes, and it's about people watching a lot of TV. And by the way, like the show The Sopranos, a lot of that show I thought was super entertaining. I thought it was a great show. And I thought some of it was very real and very realistic. And some of it was like way far, like
would never
on the other side, yeah. And I had the absolute, this is a weird story. I met Dominic Chiresi from The Sopranos.
Okay.
Junior, you know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, he sang at a restaurant downtown about 8 years ago. And I went, they had a big dinner there, and I went to the dinner. And after the dinner, I'm talking to Dominic. I just went up to him and started talking to him. Because I heard so many great stories about James Gandolfini. And I met a friend of mine who's a policeman in New York City that met James Gandolfini and was helping him with acting lessons. And it was such a weird story. So I start talking to Dominic. As I'm talking to Dominic, this girl that comes into my restaurant runs up to me and grabs my arm and says, "How do you know my father?" And I'm like, "What?" She's from Akron, Ohio, and it was Dominic's daughter.
Really?
Yeah, she lived in Akron, Ohio, and she came into my restaurant.
Did she know who you were? Like, did you guys know each other?
She knew me from La Dolce Vita. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a small world, right?
Yeah.
And she's asking me, "How do you know my dad?" I said, "I don't know your dad. I didn't know he was your dad."
I don't even know you.
I didn't even know. Well, I knew her.
Oh, okay.
And I recognized her. I didn't know her name, but I knew her from my restaurant. And I'm like, I had no idea Dominic was your dad.
Yeah.
I said, "I would have gave you a free appetizer if I knew that." You know, she was a really nice girl. But I had a, and then when he found out I knew his daughter, then he like embraced me in conversation.
Yeah.
And I had such a great conversation with him. And it was so cool to get close to somebody like that.
Yeah.
It really was. But I thought that show was well done. It was such a successful show. It was a very cool show. But it was a television show, you know, and I think the day in and day out life of mobsters is a lot more boring than Sopranos.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, like I said, it's these guys go to work, they have families, they have problems with employees, and they have the same. It's like running a business,
mm-hmm.
Except you don't have the FBI looking over your shoulder all the time, and that's why running a restaurant's a little bit easier.
Right.
Just take good care of your employees, don't abuse anybody, and pay your taxes, and you'll be okay in the restaurant business.
So while we're talking about the restaurant business, tell me a little bit about how you ended up owning a restaurant, because I know you went to school and got a degree in horticulture, so how did you take that and put it towards making a restaurant?
Well, you know that I had an opportunity. I purchased this building from my grandfather's friend, and I was with a group of guys, and I thought it had a lot of potential. And not being in the restaurant business, being a landscape designer, I had to learn on the job. And the restaurant business, by the way, I've been doing this 34 years, has changed immensely in 34 years, and especially in Cleveland, Ohio. So I went to Italy and I did a little stint in a restaurant in Rome 31 years ago. Learned a lot in Rome. I had friends in New York that had restaurants, and I would go to their restaurants and check out what they were doing, their menus. I traveled everywhere. I traveled all over Italy and checked out menus and food styles. I read. My degree in horticulture helped because I have a great understanding of produce and food, and of course I can read and understand the difference between wild caught fish and farm raised fish, veal that's raised by milk fed veal versus grain fed veal. So you know, my background in horticulture and food science and nutrition, I was able to understand a lot what was going on in the food business, and I have been doing this. They call this farm to table. I just call it going to buy some produce from farmers. That's the way it was to me, and that's the way I've been. This whole farm-to-table movement, it's cool. Those are nice words, but that's the way I have been operating my restaurant for many years.
What made you come up with the name La Dolce Vita?
I love the movie. Have you ever seen the movie?
I haven't, but
I knew you haven't.
You're
too young.
Yeah.
So one of the you know, Martin Scorsese is just obsessed with Federico Fellini, the man that directed La Strada, La Dolce Vita, Armacord, so many movies, Casanova, so many movies. Such an interesting guy, and I fell in love with the movie many years ago.
Okay.
And it's the culture of the movies, 1960s, the whole the way everybody dressed, the way they acted. Marcello Mastroianni, one of his greatest movies of all time. He's the greatest male actor in Italian history, in my opinion. And then Anita Ekberg starred in the movie, and Anouk Aimee was in the movie. So many great people were in that movie, and the movie is the kind of movie, if you haven't seen it, you will get an absolute good grip of the 1960s, European style, and it's so way ahead of its time. The camera angles, and the term paparazzi, by the way, came from that movie, if you didn't know that.
Yeah, it did. I was going to mention that and ask you about it.
I am sorry.
No, it's fine.
And, you know, just the whole drama of what occurred in that movie and how it occurred, it's so Italian.
Right.
And it's so 60s. And, I mean, you watch that movie and you think about John F. Kennedy and Jacqueline, his wife, and the First Lady, and you see the way they're dressed and the music of that movie, and Nino Rota, and, I mean, it's just an amazing movie. And the greatest part about it, it's almost, could be a little over 3 hours. Every time I watch it, I see something different. And not many movies that are made that you can say that.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend you watch it, and you'll get a real feel for Italian culture.
Yeah.
In the 60s.
Is that your favorite movie when it comes to Italian history?
I mean, there's a movie called Rocco and His Brothers. It's another famous Italian movie that I really liked a lot.
Okay.
Then there's the newer movies. Stano Tutti Bene, the same guy that made the movie Cinema Paradiso. You know the movie Cinema Paradiso? It won an Academy Award in about 1992, 93, something like that, as foreign film movies. Cinema Paradiso is one of my favorite movies of all time. I highly recommend that.
So we were talking earlier, and you were telling me about some of the things around Cleveland that I should do.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the cemetery.
Lakeview Cemetery, where John D. Rockefeller is buried, and President Garfield, and let me just say this, once a year, all the Italians from Little Italy, we go up to Lakeview. Elliot Ness is buried there,
and we all
bring a beer and we all pee on Elliot Ness's grave.
Elliot Ness is a prosecutor. He's the prosecutor, if you've watched any of my Luciano episodes or anything like that, he's the prosecutor that put Lucky Luciano in prison, and he's the one that Albert Anastasio wanted to kill. There was a few different guys. One guy got killed for wanting to kill him. I don't remember who that was, but one guy wanted to kill him and like planned to kill him, and then he got killed so that he wouldn't kill Elliot Ness. So
he was a safety director in Cleveland. I don't know if you know that.
Really? I didn't know that.
And I'm not sure, but I'm almost positive. My uncle, who was a very successful bookie, told me that Elliot Ness was a drunk.
I believe it.
And if you remember that
show... Wait a minute, I'm lying. That's definitely...
If you remember that show... the Boardwalk Show with
Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah, what I love that. He's such a great actor. What's the matter with my brain right now? But Buscemi.
Oh, Steve Buscemi.
He's such a great actor, and he did such a great part. Do you remember that G-Man in that show?
Yes.
He was kind of a drunk, kind of an idiot,
yep.
Like,
very, like, slow.
Yeah, but he kind of reminded me from the way my uncle talked about Elliot Ness as kind of a numbskull, you know? And that's the way my uncle talked about him. And I don't know this for a fact, but he died of cirrhosis of the liver, Elliot Ness did. And that is kind of, like, you talk about ironic, guy that busted all the people for prohibition, and then he gets
and then died
cirrhosis.
Of alcohol.
Yeah, that's kind of funny in a way.
Karma.
Elliot Ness is buried up there. And then the other famous guy, who the term rock and roll was Alan Freed, his grave is there. And his gravestone is a jukebox.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I'll put a picture up for you guys so you can see the jukebox. I'm sure there's a Google image on there.
And now, so the relationship between Little Italy and what occurred there is the Italians that lived here, Carabelli and his crew, were the ones that cut the stones. And if you go up to that cemetery, when you go up there, I want you to go up there, the stones are beautiful. And Rockefeller's grave is a solid granite, 60-foot tall Washington Monument. And it's right next to, and many people leave money on his gravestone. Now his youngest daughter, Alta, he donated land and built a facility for the people. He embraced the people in Little Italy. He was very good to the Italians when many people were not good to Italians. Rockefeller was very good. Rockefeller died at 97 years old, if you don't know this, in 1937. And the unique thing about Rockefeller, I have a bar that was built in Los Angeles by a famous artist by the name of Batchelder. And the artwork is the stone. The Batchelder was one of the first American ceramic tile makers. And his name is stamped on the back of all my tiles. That was purchased from Rockefeller's people in 1936 at the Great Lakes Exhibition, which was held in Cleveland, Ohio. And it's a really great piece. Billie Holiday, there was a picture I saw, Billie Holiday singing on this bar.
Oh, wow.
I can't find that picture. I saw the picture when I purchased the bar 35 years ago.
How long has the bar been open?
My bar?
Mm-hmm.
34 years.
You said that you purchased it.
I purchased that bar from Strike Pharmacy, which was in the Rockefeller building. That building was owned by John D. Rockefeller.
Okay.
Yeah, and John D. Rockefeller's people purchased that bar from the Great Lakes Exhibition in 1936 and moved it into Rockefeller's building. And that bar is what old-fashioned soda jerk bar. That's what it is.
Oh, wait, so this isn't the only restaurant that you own?
No, this is the only restaurant. No, I purchased the bar itself. Not...
Oh, like the piece?
Yeah, the
got
piece.
Got it.
The piece.
I'm like so confused.
And I moved it. No, that's all right. It's confusing. And I moved it from that building to my building.
Got it.
Yeah,
okay.
So that's the unique part about... but anyhow, Rockefeller had all these Italians that were stonecutters. And there's a very famous bridge that the Guardians, it's called the Hope Memorial Bridge. Bob Hope's father was a foreman on that bridge. Now, all the people that did the work, I will tell you, weren't Irish, they were Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones that cut the stones that, and if you look at the stone, if you look at the design, it's all Italian design, and that's the bridge that links the east side to the west side, right across from where Progressive Field is, the baseball field.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's, the Indians are called the Guardians. They changed the name to the Guardians, and that's what the Guardians were. The Guardians were on that bridge. It's a very famous, you can look it up online, the Hope Memorial Bridge, and you'll see the Guardians. Those Italian stonecutters that cut the stones in Lakeview Cemetery, they cut the bridge.
Very cool.
And that was Carabelli and all the people that worked under him.
Very interesting.
So we, Little Italy, like I said, had a lot of... very talented stonemasons, stonecutters, whatever you want to call them. My grandfather and a lot of his friends that settled here were tailors and seamstresses. And there was a doctor, this was owned by Dr. Caruso, who was the first cousin to Enrico Caruso. You know who Enrico Caruso is? The first tenor that ever lived. You don't know Enrico Caruso? The first recorded tenor in the history of opera music. The turn of the century. Caruso owned a house in Cleveland in 1907. Dr. Caruso was here. His first cousin, Dr. Baricelli, owns the Baricelli Inn. He was another doctor. So there were a lot of educated Italians that settled in this neighborhood. And Rockefeller set up the Alta House, which was a combination library, facility for athletics. There was a boxing training center there. There was a swimming pool there. There was a basketball court there. I mean...
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was really awesome. And it was named after his youngest daughter, Alta. So,
okay, Okay, so we are about to wrap up this interview. Is there anything else that you wanted to throw in there? Anything about the history of Cleveland, the history of your bar?
Cleveland's a wonderful city with a lot of very rich history. We have one of the greatest museums in the United States is the Cleveland Museum of Art. We have the top 10 orchestras in the world. If you don't know it, it's the Cleveland Orchestra. We have this whole area down here where the art museum is. We have the Natural History Museum, the Botanical Center, and Crawford Auto Museum. And in that small area over there, which is in the middle of Case Campus and University Hospital, and right next door to Cleveland Clinic, which are two of the greatest hospitals in the world, right next to all that is this unbelievably the most per square foot, the most cultural part of the United States per square foot, with those four museums.
Very nice.
Yeah. And if you get a chance, please go see. Our art museum is number two next to the Smithsonian.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll definitely check it out. I was talking about how I wanted to get at least some sightseeing things done, because I've never been to Cleveland. This is my first time, so I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, and
all right.
The strength of this city is and always been the people. We have great people here from all over the world, all over the country. This is a very ethnic city, hardworking, blue-collar, and now we have the great hospitals, which is a cherry on the top of the pie.
Awesome. All right, thank you so much for sitting down with me and
Dana, having
some conversations.
Thank you for coming to La Dolce Vita and bringing your wonderful podcast to La Dolce Vita. And I hope more people start subscribing to you.
Thank you.
And let's get so going, too. Guys. Let's get going.
Yeah, subscribers. If you're not subscribed, subscribe now. Thanks so much. I'm going to go ahead and end part three here. Thanks so much for watching. I hope you guys enjoyed part three so much that you'll be back next week for part four. That may even be the final part of Angelo Leonardo. Who knows? I'll try, but there's a lot to cover, so it's entirely possible it's not going to be the last part. Please don't forget to like, share, subscribe, comment, follow, do all the things, and I'll see you next week. Bye!